On today's show, we're making wine, not in a vineyard, but in an inner city bottle shop. We meet a wildlife carer who opens her home and heart to orphan Joeys, take part in an epic Stockman's Challenge, and we've still got time to visit a commercial worm farm. The ABC's War on Waste series has seen a big jump in demand for composting worms, and they're working overtime to keep up.
Those particular species can have up to 5 to 10 worms per egg. When worms breed, they make rabbits look sterile. Rapid breeders.
We're off to the Kookaburra Worm Farm later in the show, but first up, wine, and an urban wine project that's the toast of a local community.
Okay, so we've got 3 full barrels from 3 different grape varieties. Vineyard source all the same, so there's Chardonnay, there's Nebbiolo and there's Tannat, all from New England up in the Highlands. And all 3 of those wines are 2017 and they're just sort of resting in barrel, and beyond them are 2 steel tanks with some top-up juice.
You could be forgiven for thinking I was in a winery checking out the latest vintage. But I'm not in grape-growing country. I'm actually in inner-city Brisbane in Queensland, in a very small bottle shop in the suburb of Red Hill, where Tony Harper and his partner Tanya are running an urban wine project. They're bringing the whole winemaking process into the city, giving locals a chance to stomp, press, ferment, and finally bottle delicious red and white wines. I've caught up with Tony as he checks and tops up his barrels. The process of getting that wine into the barrels and getting all the grapes crushed, how did that happen?
That happened with a lot of help from a lot of sort of friends of craft and Red Hill people. We shipped the grapes up and we set up the crush or the press out on the footpath, and everyone gets their hands sticky and helps us with the process, and we trudge into the store and ferment in store.
We're looking at the barrels here in the middle of the store at the moment. Who do you find comes and pokes their head around and asks the most questions?
All sorts of people, but the ones that I find are most intrigued are kids. And I'm talking little kids, like 10 years old and younger, and they always want to pull the bungs out. They want to have a look. They want to have a smell. For some reason, they're really into it.
What has been one of the trickiest parts so far?
The trickiest thing is a couple of times we've pressed in store, and you know, the press, if you can imagine, it's a big wooden basket, and all of the grape juice and skins go into it, and then it gets wound down, and you end up with this fairly dry cake, and it's solid, and then you need to split that cake apart and get it out. The mess is absolutely extraordinary.
Just everywhere.
Everywhere. It is phenomenally messy.
I was going to say, up here at Red Hill, after you have the stomping days and then you'll have the bottling days, do you sort of leave that red tint with your reds around?
If you actually had it like it is, all over the walls, if I was to lift up some cartons there, you'd see it on the floor, yes.
It gives it that authenticity though, doesn't it?
It surely does. Don't get much. Oh, that's clear. Wow. So, like a week ago, I stirred that. When you ferment, and this was fermented in that barrel, so you've got all bits of solid from the grapes. You've got, you know, little flecks of skins and seeds and all sorts of crap in there, even though we've pressed it off and got the juice. But the juice is really cloudy. If you think cloudy apple juice, but worse. And then fermentation, you get all this yeast material, dead yeast, which is, it's like a really loose clay. I don't know if you've ever been done pottery, but slip, it feels like that, this, you know, really loose slimy sludge, and there'll be a big pool of that at the bottom of that barrel. So every couple of weeks I stir that up and through it, and it gets really cloudy. But, and you can see that's more cloudy than your standard bottle of wine, but it's pretty clear compared to what it was a week ago when I did it. So the fun thing about this process is there's a bunch of people have tried that since it was really sticky grape juice. And then they'll come in tonight and taste it now as, you know, 3/4 finished wine. But this might be the 20th time they've tasted it. So you get that whole evolution.
And do you find that that is why people are drawn to it, that they get to see what they've taken part of and they get to be part of that hands-on process?
Yes, absolutely. And everyone who helps gets handed a few bottles at the end, which is kind of fun. There we go, big suction. This is my favourite grape variety on the planet, and I reckon it's maybe the hardest variety to get right.
It still smells fruity, but you get that rose petal.
So what happens from now, Tony?
Not a great deal, apart from checking the wines every couple of weeks and topping the barrels up, because they do lose that little bit all the time, so keeping them full's paramount. The two reds will need to go through malolactic, so when spring comes and temperature's warm, I'll come in one morning and those bungs will have flown out, because that ferment builds pressure and all of a sudden it's pow, out will come the bungs, and I'll know they're going through malo. And that, like when you tasted that young tannat versus the three-year-old tannat, part of that shift is malolactic, which softens the acids and makes everything a bit rounder and smoother, I guess. Keep it as natural as I possibly can. The Chardonnay, it'll get bottled first. So once I've decided it's either ready or it's not going to get any better, there's a tipping point, I think. I'm fairly novice at this, but you can leave and fiddle, and then there's a tipping point where you're not gaining traction, you're losing it. And I think good winemaking is knowing that point, when to go, right, get it in bottle. It's just going to get worse.
And how tricky is it to be making wine in these sort of conditions? It would have to be a love project.
It was really tricky for the first couple of years, but we've worked out a system. And we used to do a lot of it on the footpath and then trek it all in. And we've actually worked out that we're better off clearing a space in the winery, in the shop, and doing most of it in here. Otherwise, you just spread mess. The initial crush we always do out there because it attracts lots of attention. It's good fun and you need the space. But bottling will do in here. We've got pretty good at it. Got faster and neater.
So what happens then on bottling day? Do you invite some people back, or is it just you guys bottling the wine?
No. Every step of the way, I send out an email or a Facebook, Instagram, mm-hmm. social media thing, and we invite people. The more the merrier. Many hands make light work. So we love people coming along, helping out.
Do you find that inviting the community in and teaching them about this process and giving them that hands-on feeling creates a good sense of letting people see inside the wine business?
That's the whole point. It is the absolute whole point.
Yeah. I feel like a proud mum. They're my children. You get very attached to them.
Carol Cosentino is talking about her fairy family, the orphaned kangaroos, wallabies and other wildlife she cares for at her suburban home near Collinsville, a mining town an hour's drive inland from Bowen in North Queensland. Carol and her husband Vince have welcomed hundreds of animals into their home over the years. Hello, I'm Sophie Meixner. Most of them have come in as young joeys, rescued from the roadside after their mothers have been killed by passing traffic.
We've called our place Warriyumba, which is the local Biri language for kangaroo house. We've been doing this regularly for 21 years. Originally I was the mad gardener, and then I went into land care, and then people started bringing me baby birds, and then it just grew from there. When I saw the need for our local wildlife that were being injured and orphaned by human contact, I realised that they needed our help. And they just took over our lives. We've cared for hundreds. It's very quiet at the moment, but sometimes we've had anything from 50. One time we even had over 20, which was a bit of a strain, but we can usually handle 10 or more quite easily here.
And so some of these animals come to you seriously injured. How did they get injured mostly?
Mostly by cars, because they're, people driving very fast and on the roads. A lot of people think that they're such good drivers they can swerve around and miss them. But that's a fallacy, because kangaroos can change direction in mid-air. The best thing to do if you see a kangaroo up in front is to slow down and sometimes stop. Because sometimes that animal is a bit confused, not sure where to go. So if you slow down and stop, you give it time to make up its mind.
It's not just kangaroos and wallabies at this wildlife sanctuary. As you can hear, there's lots of birds and other native animals here as well.
And I still do birds. We still rescue snakes, and we're interested in all the wildlife, because when I was growing up, there was no one to teach me the native wildlife for our area. and I felt very ignorant of what was here. And so this has given me a wonderful opportunity to learn about what's here and to appreciate it. And we also maintain an open house for locals or backpackers or whoever to come and enjoy them and to appreciate them and to learn.
While we've been talking, a very timid young wallaroo called Abby has been watching on. She's gathered up the courage to move in closer.
Abby's getting brave now. She's coming up to investigate. And that's where people, if they stay for a couple of days, the animals get used to them and treat them like pieces of the furniture.
Since Abby's hopped up onto the veranda with us, can you tell me a little bit about her story and how she got to the kangaroo house?
Well, she was hiding in her mother's pouch on the road to Bowen for 2 days before somebody checked her pouch and found her. She wasn't injured, but she was pretty dehydrated and very frightened and not very comfortable. And so she was very fortunate that the person went to move the dead mother off the road. She'd been decapitated, and found her. And she was so appreciative to have a nice warm bag and a nice drink of milk when she got here. And she's been very loving and affectionate ever since.
So how old is she now?
Over 12 months. Probably another couple of months and she'll be ready for release.
So you do, if you can, you do release all of them once they're ready to go back out into the wild?
Yes. My yard here, my double block, is not big enough to keep them into maturity. And also too, when they get really big, their hormones kick in and they can become quite a handful.
Yeah.
It's not fair to keep them in such a small area, because the minute you put them out in the open space, their strides just lengthen. And you know, when you see them going for a mad gallop around the yard, it's that joie de vivre, and you feel like you're not being fair to them to keep them in such a small area.
What about you when you let them go? Is it a bit bittersweet? Are you obviously happy that they're healthy, but is it sad to say goodbye?
Always, always. But it's very satisfying to see them travelling so calmly and getting out and looking around and going for a wander and then saying, all right, I've had a look around now, I want to get back in the car. But where we release are some very nice people who keep an eye out for them and are not averse to them going up to visit them. So it's a very quite soft release. Yeah, we haven't had any bad reports of animals getting distressed at all from it. You know, they just get on with their life.
Carol Constantino opening up her home and her heart to those orphaned and injured animals at Collinsville in North Queensland. And she was speaking with Sophie Meixner. You're listening to A Country Breakfast on RN. Now, do you have a worm farm in your backyard, composting away all those kitchen scraps? I know all my kids were fascinated by their worm farm at kinder. Well, if you do, there's a good chance it comes from the Kookaburra Worm Farm, one of the biggest commercial operations in Australia.
It's unique. All I can say, it's very unique. It's something very different. Very few really commercial scale worm farms in Australia. I absolutely enjoy it. I've been doing it for 27 years. Love the industry, love the business, love getting my hands dirty because that's what worms make.
Yep.
Is dirt or soil.
You can hear the enthusiasm in George Mingan's voice. He just loves getting his hands dirty as a worm farmer. Hello, I'm Brad Marcellus at the Kookaburra Worm Farm near Gingin, just to the west of Bundaberg in southern Queensland. I'm standing outside a large, climate-controlled and fully insulated shed where George and his wife Kath breed thousands of worms for fishing bait and also compost and earthworms for use by home gardeners and farmers. And I've just witnessed something that is extraordinary. I didn't even know that worms came from an egg, which is terrible, and you've just birthed, well, you describe it for me, George.
Yes, worms do lay eggs in a very non-traditional way. They shed them from the outside instead of the inside. And after about 3 weeks, you get little worms popping out of eggs. And what we just did was a little bit of a cesarean section by looking at the worms popping out of the eggs.
And we had twins.
Yes, that was twins. That was actually a fairly small one. Those particular species can have up to 5 to 10 worms per egg. When worms breed, they make rabbits look sterile. Rapid breeders.
From egg to hitting the shelves of the big hardware shops, how long a process is that?
From the egg to the shelf is about a 3 to 6 month process, depending how efficiently it's working.
So if big order comes in, it does take you a while to get them on the shelves?
Yes, that's one thing. We can't really cope with big fluctuations in orders. So we rely on history very much. And now with this war on waste and whatever else is happening, people's awareness is suddenly ballooning about worms and the benefit to the environment with worms. Yeah, we find it very difficult to cope with sudden changes. As I said, it's a minimum 3 months to be able to produce a worm.
Now, you might have heard a horse in the background there. They play an important role in the breeding program here at Kookaburra Worm Farm. We are standing next to a large cool room. Just describe what's going on in the cool room and where it goes in the paddock next to us.
This cool room's actually called a fodder solutions machine, and it is a sprouting room. We sprout barley, and in 6 days we've got about 150 mil to 200 mil long grass, what we call biscuits of grass. And this grass we used to feed directly to the worms, but we found there were problems with that. So we now put them through the animals you see in the paddock there, which we actually call turners, because they turn that grass into terrific quality manure. And that manure we feed to the worms. And that's a preferred food for worms. Alternative name for compost worms is manure worms. And by the way, they're not too fussed whose manure they eat.
Now, we did just take a walk down the worm hotel, the production room, which is lines of worms in crates growing. Very dark, very cool environment. I could see the passion, George, for the worms as you held them and looked at them and talking about them now. Where does this love for worms come from?
Look, I'm what I call a pragmatic greenie, and I have been for many, many, many years. And by being pragmatic, I like to do things that work for the environment. And to me, worms are at the base of our whole food chain. And in fact, people like Charles Darwin said, earthworms are probably the most important aspect of soils. And Aristotle, you heard of him, the Greek philosopher, he actually said, earthworms are like the intestines of the earth. I mean, that really rings so true to me, and I see it happening every day. We produce top soils from our worms.
So it's a test of endurance and strength, and also a little bit of bush skills in there as well.
And here comes. That's the way to go.
Jody Keogh, who's the organiser of the Man of Martin's Waterhole, explaining what the challenge is all about. G'day, I'm Eric Barker on Taldora Station in northwest Queensland, about 150 kilometres north of Julia Creek. Now, crowds have converged on this dusty arena for the annual Saxby Roundup Rodeo, which also features this two-day novelty stockman's challenge. Jody Keogh explains what the competitors have to do.
Okay, so Friday we start with a nice fresh swim in the waterhole, and that's topped off with a run around the arena, so that's our first event. And then later we had the stick horse cutout, so just like your camp drafting, except you're not on a real horse, you're on a stick of your choice. So that's always a crowd pleaser, that one. And on Friday night we then had the whip cracking competition, which is very entertaining, topped off with an arm wrestle competition, which the bar crowd love as well.
Now, we've just seen a little obstacle course here. It's about mid-afternoon on Saturday. What was that?
Okay, so the obstacle course, it looks fun for the spectators, and it's probably not that fun for the competitors, but look, they start with some solid push-ups, and then they jump a 44-gallon drum, and then they have to push a large round bale of hay across the line and back, and top it off with balancing on a 44-gallon drum across the finishing line, and then top that off with a nice cold beer after their hard efforts. So that's also a bit of fun to watch.
Mount Isa paramedic Mario Tinning is one of those putting his body on the line in this Stockman's Challenge. The opening rounds have been tough, and he's got the bareback horse ride, a bull ride, and an all-important talent quest to go.
I shouldn't have anything to complain about. I'm not as old as some of the other competitors here, but the water, I will be honest, the water was quite cold, so that had a bit of a bite in the morning. But yeah, no, not too bad. You just got to get yourself back up and keep going, hey?
Well, Mario, we've still got plenty to go for the Man of Martin's Waterhole. Do you mind taking us through it as you go for the rest of the day?
Yeah, mate, absolutely.
For John and Alina Murphy there from Mount Isa.
The competitors have moved over to the arena for the bareback boot race.
So what we've got to do is sprint over to our boots, which will be in the middle of the arena, chuck our boots on, sprint over to the horse, and then from there we sprint back on the horse bareback. So I've never ridden a horse bareback before, so it's going to be pretty interesting.
And despite some big cheers from the crowd, Mario spent most of his bareback ride on the ground.
I kept sliding on the back, so she kept bucking me off. I had to get back on there and keep going. Hey, you don't stop, unfortunately. But yeah, no, good fun.
I feel like once you got on a roll, though, you were right.
Yeah, once we got going, hey.
All right, Mario, couple of falls. How are you feeling for the talent quest?
Yeah, good. My arm's a bit sore after those few falls, but just got to keep going. I've got to do, I've nominated myself for the bullock ride in the rodeo. So hopefully I walk out of that in one piece.
We're here on Saturday night for the talent quest. Have you looked at the scores?
No, I haven't, to be honest. I know I'm definitely not placing, but once you commit, you've got to go hardcore. You don't stop, even if you're coming last. So, we're hoping to entertain the crowd and have a few laughs and go from there, to be honest, more than anything.
Mario, you just rode tight on your first ever bull ride.
Mate, completely unrelated. It was all a stroke of luck, but the mind's focused now here in the talent quest. So it was good fun. Don't get me wrong, it was good fun, but now we're here. And here's my competition over here, Lane.
Lane, I believe Lane's got a grease lightning
Lane's
number going on.
As well.
Oh, yeah, are you leading the competition, Lane?
Yeah, I think we're tied at the moment.
You and Pitt.
Yeah.
You and Pitt. I'm not placing at this stage, but yeah, no. We'll see how it goes. This might come down to the final talent quest, see what happens, hey.
Are you hoping to make up a few points?
I'd like to, but at the end of the day, it's all going to be down to the perception and perspective of the judges. So if they like it, they like it. If they don't, then no qualms. You just got to go with it.
Lane, do you reckon you can keep him away?
Mate, Mario's a bit slippery, eh? I think he's got this one in the bag.
Despite an impressive breakdancing display, it wasn't enough for Mario to get the win. Here's Jodie Keogh again.
The winner of the Man of Martin's Waterhole is Lane Keogh.
And it was getting pretty close yesterday, Lane, until I feel like you really pulled away at the bar last night. Can you run us through your performance?
Oh, mate, we had a bit of a grease lightning skit going on. Lucky for me, I think my wife and my little beautiful daughter stole the show for me.
I tell you what, your performance for the Grease Lightning performance at the Talent Quest looked very, very well choreographed. Had you guys been practicing as a family beforehand?
Oh, mate, we give it just one or two quick runs about an hour before, but not overly. Just throw it in the mix and see how we go.
Well, thanks so much for your time, guys. You've been absolutely fantastic sports about it all. And hopefully we'll see it, do it again next year.
We will do it again next year, and your name is on the top of the list. Entered already.
Stockman's Challenge organiser Jodie Keogh there, laying down the gauntlet to our Mount Isa rural reporter, Eric Barker. And if you're wondering, Jodie is Lane Keogh's partner and part of that winning greased lightning routine on the dance floor. Boy, was that a bit of a flashback. You can check out Eric's online feature at abc.net.au/radionational.